promise not to cry today.
It's early. You got plenty of time to, you know, bring up something really emotional and get you to cry.
We're trying not to do that every week. How about that? I'm here with my co-host, Burl Love, and today's special guests, I don't actually think are going to make me cry, to be honest, although I would have said that last week, too, and here we were with Nolia Chef Jeffrey Harris, and I was crying. But today's special guest is, it's a very special guest with an S at the end, is Lisa Sauer, a longtime Arts Wave emeritus on the board of Arts Wave, and her husband, John Moeller, who you might recognize that name. He's chairman of the board and president and chief and CEO of Procter & Gamble, and they're going to co-chair the Arts Wave campaign this year. And so it's the powerhouse couple behind that. But we are going to talk about the importance of Arts Wave to our community for sure. But they have a good story about themselves. And then, of course, I think we have to talk about Procter & Gamble as one of our most important businesses.
Yeah, we would be remiss if we didn't get him to talk about his day job for a little bit while he's here. Again, to talk about Arts Wave, which is, for those unfamiliar, a very long-standing organization in our community that raises and distributes money for local arts. It'll be interesting to see how they got involved and what they have in store for the campaign this year. But first, before we bring in our special guest, Sherry, we were talking a few weeks ago how it seemed that the city wasn't really generating much news. I mean, that's your primary beat, covering City Hall. Things seemed a little quiet, but not last week.
We're off to the races, you guys.
I mean, it's all of a sudden they're everywhere. We are looking at banning new parking lots. We are looking at trying to spur new housing. All kinds of things came out last week, including you were summoned to a briefing by the mayor that occurred, get this, everybody, this is how hard Sherry works for you all, 6 p.m. on a Saturday night.
You know what? It was really nice of the mayor to do it. The mayor was out of town on some personal...
Wait a minute. Sherry, you are woman about town. Surely you had better things to do on a Saturday night than go listen to a policy update from the mayor.
You know what? When you're the City Hall reporter, and there are very esoteric and deep involved things like that were rolled out, like the zoning overhaul that's coming, you actually beg for backgrounders before a press conference, because you have to understand the nuances of it that you can't with TV cameras and real people are watching. You need time to understand things to write a really good story. And so we're really in a good group with the city briefing reporters and helping out on background. But he was out of town on some personal business, and at the time that he could do it was Saturday at 6 p.m. And
you were there.
You don't say no, but you guys.
And you were there.
Alex and I have the best story ever now. We were going to UC's basketball game. I'll probably talk about that at the end.
We are.
I knew we'd be a little bit late. I didn't know how long this would take, but here's how this is going to work. We're at home, then we're going to go to the mayor's briefing, but he could just wait for me. We're not going to bore him with zoning in the city. He could wait for me, and then we'll go up to UC from downtown at City Hall. But turns out Alex is a reporter, and he listens to what I report on. I listen to what he reports on. It's going to come in handy today. And he was kind of hovering at the door, and the mayor's like, you could come in, right? And so Alex came in, and he joined the interview and was asking questions, and he really was he really understood what this all meant to the business community and everything. But I mean, now it is a story we'll probably tell forever, because I don't know what you all do on date nights, but Alex and I apparently go to zoning briefings at City Hall on Saturday night. That's what we do.
It sounds captivating. But all kidding aside, and I was kidding. I have a lot of respect for the mayor's sincerity in wanting to sit down.
This is a big initiative.
Get into the weeds, explain the nuance. Because there's so much that can be realized when you can sit down and understand policies that are going to affect the future of the city. So a couple headlines, Sherry, give them to me.
So it's a the biggest zoning overhaul in 20 years. A lot of things happening at the zoning level. You guys, actually, I always tell people, this is speaking of esoteric, if you care about what's going on in your community, watch what's happening with zoning, because that changes everything, because that's what's, that means what's allowed and what's not allowed. This was 2 years ago called like the density ordinance. It failed. It was kind of a surprise. They've been working on really involving the community in changing on how dense buildings can be. But we are talking about the inside of buildings here and what is allowed to be built without going through these complicated zoning processes, really trying to make it more attractive for developers to build critically needed housing in our community. The mayor called it like the middle housing to kind of fill in things, but like row houses, two, three, four apartment, utilizing the buildings that we already have. It could be new too. And they're in our 39 business districts and along transit routes. This is a very long process. We'll be talking a lot about this because the mayor is very sincere about giving people time. This hasn't always been the case at City Hall before him, or even, you know, in the last couple years. You know, things tend to get introduced and voted on. This is a very long process. There's going to be hearings. People are going to have a chance to weigh in. The laws aren't even written yet, so they can be changed. They'll be written kind of in May, and then a vote before summer recess in July. So big, long process coming here.
But the end goal being a overhaul of policy that affects housing in the city.
Yes. And then in turn, the business districts. The more people you bring in, the more, you know, the businesses thrive. I am very interested in the conversation that happens around this, because as I look at it, it seems like good policy, especially as I looked around the country at other cities that are doing this or trying to do this. It seems like best practices, and I'm interested in hearing all the different points of view emerge. And I'm glad that we have time for the different points of view to emerge.
So for the layperson, can you give me one example of a change, a zoning change, that is needed to spur that increase in housing?
So right now, there was a very long, complicated like slide deck of things. But one of the slide decks showed something that I thought was interesting. When you look at our business districts, like let's take Hyde Park only because it's such a high profile one, but they range in the gamut. You look at the different buildings that are there. Well, like right now, there's all kind of parking requirements that if you build a certain amount of units, you have to have a certain amount of parking. Where are you putting the parking if you're building in Hyde Park Square or any of these business districts? You'd have to tear down a building. You'd have to buy the two buildings, redo one, and tear one down to create the parking for the building. And they're like, that's not what we need to do anymore. That's not best practice. You don't have to, so one of the zoning changes is you don't have to have as much required parking for what you're going to do, because they don't want to build parking. They want to reuse the buildings that are there and make them more practical and put people in them.
So acknowledging things like people who want to live in walkable neighborhoods that aren't required or relying on their cars as much as they might have been in the past, those types of changes.
Really goes back to what Daryl Haley was telling us when he was on the podcast, like creating these big transit routes, north and south, east and west, and these changes are along those routes. So these two things are going hand in hand, which is some massive coordination, you guys. Trust me, I see things happen, you know, here. It's like the right hand's doing one thing, the left hand's doing the other. But here, this is all the city's working in tandem with what the transit system's doing. That you can get around. And it is an interesting way of looking at this.
And just a reminder, when we talk about things like this, I think it's natural for people to think about the Central Business District and downtown. But you mentioned Hyde Park. So this is a citywide, all neighborhoods, top to bottom.
Recognized business districts, which turns out there's 39 of them. Because, you know, we have 52 neighborhoods, but everyone doesn't have a business district.
Okay,
Madisonville, Oakley,
right.
West Price Hill.
39 business districts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I got to say, it's a little wonky.
I know. I love it, guys.
But I think it's something that is going to, like you said, it's going to evolve. This isn't going to happen quickly. I think you're probably going to be very busy, you know, digging into this and trying to decode it for the average person who might not be.
Yes, because there was a lot of concern from real people in the neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And I did very much concentrate my story on what, like, you really aren't going to see so many changes. The most a building really can be is one story higher than now. And historic preservation rules in the city, which are very important in many of the areas, trump everything. That was a very important question to me. Like, nothing, you can't be like, oh, well, these new zoning laws mean I can just make some ugly, like, fourplex. If you're in a historic district, it has to look and follow all the historic rules first, and then the zoning kicks in.
Well, while we're on the topic of parking, the other interesting story was the vote to put a ban or a moratorium on brand new surface lots downtown.
This is a year and a half in the making. This city council ran on being very climate friendly, and they are like, that's it. We are done building surface parking lots in our urban core. There's better uses of land. Parking lots, if you know, when in the scheme of climate, you hear the city council talk a lot about how it overheats the urban area, these like concrete, you know, just...
Or blacktop even worse,
right?
Yeah.
And they're like, and so they are concerned about that, but it's also just not the best use of land when you want, you know, there's not that much land downtown, and they want to spur people to use land in better ways. And I will say, at Equitable Housing Committee, we haven't written about this, but we did see a project go through in O'Brienville. It's actually a surface parking lot that somebody bought, like, and not like one of the big developers that we talk about all the time. Just a developer bought this. It's surrounded by razor wire right now. There's no real use for it right this minute. It's not being used. It's just this old lot. And they're building a 19 apartment unit building on it. And they're bringing housing. So it didn't really fall under the parking rules, but it's kind of what council is trying to spur by, you know, banning these new surface lots.
What I thought was interesting in that story was the percentage of parking available on any given day or event in the city. And what I learned from about that, because, you know, when you come downtown and it's a busy, you know, there's a big event and it's, you know, very active with a lot of people, it seems like, oh my gosh, there's nowhere to park. But even on those days, we were like at most 80% capacity. Like, there's, you know, if you're willing to walk a few blocks, if you're willing to not use a surface lot and go to one of the many parking structures that we have, we don't have a problem right now, according to your reporting, with a shortage of parking spaces. It's
no,
almost
agree.
The opposite.
You know what? It's very Midwestern of us, and I'm guilty of it too, that we just want to park like super close and walk in a building. But that is not the best use of urban core land. If you live in the suburbs, you go to Target and you park in a parking lot, you walk in the store. But you park in parking garages when you're, that's the best use of how, that's what parking is supposed to be in urban. Speaking of wonky, I've actually read books on parking, Burl, like best practices on parking. The city does struggle in the neighborhoods a little bit. It's a whole different conversation,
right? Mm-hmm.
Of like with the residential parking permits and how that all works. And that probably something that still needs to be worked on. We're not talking about that right now. That's not a conversation really happening. But we're just used to this idea of like we park and we're able to walk in the exact, you know, place we want to. It's steps away, and that is just not what a good urban core is.
Well, as a spoiled Midwesterner / Cincinnatian, I remember when I was working in the D.C. area, USA Today's offices are in McLean, which is in Northern Virginia, and I thought, and I had, you know, a couple times a week, I needed to be at our Washington Bureau, which is, you know, in the district, on I Street, in the middle of everything, and the first time I needed to go down there, I just jumped in my car and thought, I'll find a place to park. That'll be, you know, it'll be no problem. And I did, but it took like literally 45 minutes, you know. And I thought, this is not the way to go. I'm going to get on the Metro next time. And I became a true believer, you know, like the Metro. People want to complain about the DC Metro. It got me from point A to point B. The only problem I ever had on the Metro was when I wasn't paying attention and I didn't get off at my stop and I had to backtrack. which rookie move.
So I've done that. But I've driven by exits on the highway. And, you know, we moved buildings. We've talked about that on this podcast. Sometimes I just kind of mindlessly drive in the old building and I'm like, I don't work here anymore.
But unless you have it, you know, you're paying for monthly parking and you have a designated space, you know, in a city like D.C., you just don't have the expectation at all that you're going to find a place to park. You just don't. And we have that expectation in Cincinnati. I mean,
but we're trying, they're trying to change.
That's one of the charms, you know. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how this does develop, because I do think there is going to be that expectation that I should be able to park downtown. But it might not be the way it looks right now. You're not going to find as many surface lots. You're going to have to look for parking structures. You might have to take, you know, dare I mention the streetcar or something like that to get, you know, closer if you don't feel like walking. It is wonky, but it's also fascinating because it's just an example of how change is coming to our city.
And it is about being a city. That's the overarching topic that we're talking about.
If we weren't growing, if we weren't projected to grow as a city, we wouldn't have these problems. We'd be having other problems that are way more difficult to deal with. So, all right. Thanks for listening to Wonkfest, everybody. We will now welcome our guests.
Special guest here on That's So Cincinnati. I'm so excited to welcome our guests today, John Mueller and Lisa Sauer. And we are going to talk about Procter & Gamble in our community, but we are here to talk about Arts Wave today. And so I think let's get started with that, because it's time to kick off the campaign for something very important to our community.
It's great. Yes, we're excited to be here. Thank you.
So as I said earlier, you're the co-chairs of Arts Wave this year. That's very romantic. Is this something? But Lisa, tell us a little bit. You've been involved in Arts Wave for a very long time.
Right. I've been on the board for about 12 years and really got involved because P&G has always led an Arts Wave campaign as part of two of the campaigns they support in the company. And so they needed somebody on the board of Arts Wave to represent P&G. And so that's when I started to get involved. And that's when I really went from being just a donor who thinks, of course, the arts are important to the city, to seeing how Arts Wave spends the money, raises the money, and how diligently they do their work. And then I became very passionate about Arts Wave through that process.
I do want to talk about what Arts Wave is, because people do tend to get it mixed up with artworks, and they're two very different things, two amazing things, but very different things. Can you tell us about what Arts Wave is?
Sure. Arts Wave is an organization that raises money for the arts and then grants it back to the arts organizations in the community. The purpose is to make sure that we have a thriving arts community, and arts communities need, the ticket price doesn't pay for everything. So, or the arts need additional support, and oftentimes the hardest money to raise is the general operating budgets. Nobody likes to give money to keep the lights on, and so that's the money that Arts Wave raises, and they raise it from broadly from the community. About 25,000 people donate each year to Arts Wave, and then they grant it out based on impact. So the goal for Arts Wave is a more vibrant economy and a more connected community through the arts.
And we're talking about everything from the smallest theaters that we have in our neighborhoods, right, in all the way up to our big arts, the opera and the symphony, and everyone gets some sort of help, right?
Right. They support about 150 arts organizations. The vast majority of the money goes to the largest arts organizations, obviously, because they have the biggest impact in the city, and it's based on impact. But the story of Arts Wave is really great. It started in 1927, and so it's almost 100 years old.
Do most cities have something like this, or is this unique to Cincinnati?
There are other organizations that raise money for the arts in other cities, but Arts Wave is the largest community fund in the city.
In the country.
And so what does this year's campaign look like?
This is an important campaign for a number of reasons. as you can readily appreciate, COVID was not friendly to the arts in terms of people's ability to participate, in terms of just the physical activity and the proximity of people in producing, for example, performance art. And not only was that an impact, but just like you and I have been dealing in our personal lives with a significant amount of inflation, so have the arts. And so the annual giving amount is below pre-COVID levels on an absolute basis. It's well below pre-COVID levels on a real basis, adjusted for inflation. And we need to make that up. And we're excited to be a part of working with our community and doing that. And why is that important? We feel that the arts are a significant part of a significant component of a vibrant community. And as CEO of P&G, that's important to me, not only because I live in the community, but we need to be able to attract, develop, and retain the best talent in the world. And it's difficult to do that without a thriving art scene. Think about New York without the Met, without Lincoln Center, without Broadway, without MoMA or the Metropolitan, without the Statue of Liberty. It's not the same thing. Nor would our city, our community, our broad community, be what it has the potential to be without the arts. So it's a very important year for the campaign, and we're excited to be helping with it.
It is money that does need to be raised like this, because if you think about the other things in those kind of categories that make us want to live here, all of our professional sports teams and some of these other things, they have public support. And
correct.
They come from, you know, the sales tax or different ways or different kind of grants, but that's not where the arts are getting their money, and that this was a private funding stream.
Exactly. So, for example, I served on the board of the Cincinnati Art Museum for 10 years. Two as president, two as chairman. We don't charge admission. We don't charge for parking. All of the revenue that's needed to support that institution and its outreach efforts into the community comes from either donors directly to the museum or through ArtsWave.
So I'm familiar with the corporate campaign. We have done some here at the Enquirer. I'm sure not as big as the one that Procter & Gamble does in size, but I would
There's
like to say...
There's always room for improvement.
Exactly. There you are. The Procter & Gamble CEO just gave me a stretch goal. I like that. I was going to say, but I hope equal in passion and care. So that's how I'm familiar with the campaign. Working through companies in town. What are the other facets and how does it break down? Like, where is it a mix of companies and private donors? Are there ways for people to get involved if they don't have a corporate campaign, for example? How does
Great
that
question.
All, what are the facets of the campaign?
Yes, yeah, so the corporate campaigns are still the largest part of giving, and that's really important because it's direct access to a lot of employees. And and it used to be they were all in the office, and so that was a great way to raise money. But individual donors are equally in a very important part of the campaign. And you can give to ArtsWave. If you hear us today and you say, oh, I want to give to ArtsWave, you can go to ArtsWave, Google ArtsWave on the internet, and right up on the page when you get to ArtsWave in Cincinnati, you'll see how to give. So you can give, and there are benefits of giving, not only just the satisfaction of knowing that you're making our city better, but there are donor benefits for different levels of giving. And there are things like buy one, get one free tickets. There are back of the experiences on Blink. You can get benefits that you can't get otherwise.
It is a Blink year. It'll be here before we know
Exciting.
It.
When someone becomes a supporter of Arts Waves, I know this firsthand, you do get a lot of information about the benefits of being a member, all the various organizations that are under the umbrella, let's say. It was, you know, I probably have a greater awareness because of my job of all the different arts organizations and opportunities in town. But when I saw it listed like that, it was a little eye-opening for me, all of the various art organizations, especially the smaller ones that aren't on people's radar. We think of, you know, the art museum, obviously. We think of things like the ballet. But tell me a little bit about how important Art Waves is to the smaller organizations.
Arts Waves gifts to smaller organizations are critical. So they Arts Wave tries not to be a big portion of anybody's budget because they don't want anybody to be singularly dependent, but they're maybe 5 to 6% of organizations, or maybe even more than that, 5 to 10% of organizations' budgets. And it's money that is hard to come by. So you'll hear from small organizations that they made it through the year because of Arts Wave. And if you think of the pandemic and what just happened, Arts Wave played a major role in helping large and small organizations make it through the pandemic, both by advancing some funding and loans to the organization, but also by getting the organizations to work together and share, what are you learning? What are you doing? How are you making it through? What are you going to say to the community? When are you letting people back in? All those things they did together, and that was really organized by Arts Wave because they can play that convening role for all the arts organizations.
And I would say they work hard to ensure that there's a pipeline of arts organizations in the city. Our city, our country is increasingly diverse in its interface with the arts, and having something that appeals to different groups of people becomes very important to community. So they're it's with great intentionality that they pursue a diversity of giving across the institutions in the city.
It's one of the things you learn when you volunteer. So people might like to know that anyone can volunteer at Arts Wave because the grants that Arts Wave gives to the arts organizations are, all those grant decisions are made by community volunteers, which people might be interested in. And obviously it's a rigorous process that they're executing. But when you give away money, and I thought, oh, the first time I worked on a grants panel, oh, this will be so great. Giving away money must be so easy. But it is not easy because really people are, all the organizations are doing very good things. And but ArtsWave does have an agenda to drive. They're trying to get to a more vibrant economy and a more connected community that includes diversity. So diverse, having diverse boards is very important, having diverse audiences, having diverse performances. That's one of the criteria there, and it's very important that ArtsWave pushes for those things in order for us to be leading in the community and have what the community really needs.
I mean, I see that covering the city during budget time because they support so many groups that need the money, and I do oftentimes, I'm like, I don't know how they pick because there's only so much money and there's so much need.
So speaking of so much money, what is the goal this year?
Well, we can't let you in on that because we haven't decided yet.
Okay. You know, we like when our guests break news. I was trying to get out ahead, I guess.
What I can tell you is that the highest amount raised by in the community campaign in the past was about $12.5 million. And that was in 2016. So that would be worth $16 million today in today's dollars. We're not going to go for a goal of 16 because we haven't done that, but we would like to get to we would like to at least get back to pre-pandemic levels and hopefully a bit beyond that.
I mean, if anyone could do it, I feel like they picked the best people.
Well, I'm guessing they to land the dream team, the couple, the power couple that you are, they must have worked through you, Lisa. Is that right? Or am I wrong? I was just making a guess.
I think they asked both of us. A couple of years ago, actually, several years ago, to start thinking about it. As you can imagine, P&G, it's P&G's turn every once in a while to run a campaign. And the last time we were in charge was about 10 years ago. So it's our turn again.
So that's how it's organized. You are on the hook.
Yeah. We like to be treated independently. And I think they did a very good job of that.
Okay.
But it was a no-brainer, really, to say yes. Getting back to something we were talking about earlier, which is the importance of arts in the community. My role, part of my role, an important part of my role is ensuring that we have a vibrant community that does attract and allows us to retain the best talent in the world. So there's nothing incongruent about this and the work that I do on a daily basis.
And so I totally agree with that, even in my retired life. But I also think that art makes life better. And I think it makes life visually better, emotionally better, creatively better. So it's a win-win.
And so you've also taken on, in the theme of like making things better in the community where we live, you also have taken on basically like the chairmanship of the Futures Commission, which we've written a lot here at Cincinnati.com. There's no breaking news today, you guys. They're not done yet. I wish I could say like everything that's happening with it, but it's, you know, it's a big task that the Futures Commission has taken on. So it's taking a little bit of time. But talk a little bit about like that's important too and why you would do something like that.
Well, it's all about community. We're an important member of the community, as are the other 30 plus commissioners that are helping with this effort. They come from all walks of life, both the private sector and the public sector, really are a good representative group for our city. And I've believed for some period of time, and certainly continue to believe, that this community's brightest days are ahead of it, but recognizing all that's possible requires a degree of intentionality. It also requires that we address some of the challenges that could potentially get in the way from achieving those objectives. And as a person who resides within the greater city, Lisa and I live just across the river in Covington, I just feel it's a great opportunity to help out.
So we have a couple non-Arts Wave questions we want to get to, but since both of you are here, the background story you have is fascinating to a lot of people. You actually, Lisa, started at Procter & Gamble before John, is that correct? Lisa's an intern?
I was an intern, and then I started maybe a couple months before I'm full-time.
And so you suggested, hey, you might want to apply here at Procter & Gamble.
It was a little more direct than that.
Oh, tell me.
Because you lived somewhere else, right? And so you had to come here.
So Lisa interned with Procter & Gamble during between the 2 years of business school, so in the summer. And I spent that summer on Wall Street in New York on the buy side of the market. And when I got back to Cornell, where we were both going to school together and had been dating for some time, Lisa said, I've received a full-time offer from Procter & Gamble. I'm moving to Cincinnati. You need to decide what you are going to do.
Aha.
I don't remember it exactly.
Of course you don't.
Because I remember looking for other jobs with you. But.
Yeah, well, we wanted to make sure we understood all of our opportunities. But anyway, I was fortunate enough to also have a brief internship with P&G over the Christmas holidays that year. And really, you know, it's interesting. One of the most common questions I get is, why did you come to P&G? I've given you that answer. But why did you stay there for 35 years? And those reasons were evident to me from day one. The first was, is, that I've learned something every day. This company has shown me the world, literally. The second was it was a place where a contribution was expected. And I wanted to contribute both to the business and the organization. And third was that I've walked out of a door of a P&G building somewhere in the world every day for 35 years, knowing that I'd been paid that day to do what was right. And that combination of qualities, learning, an expectation of contribution in an environment that matches with your own personal value system was what attracted me here and what's kept me here.
So, Lisa, when this was happening 30 some years ago, did you have an inkling that not only am I going to encourage him to work at Procter & Gamble, but at some point he's going to be my boss as the CEO?
No, I wanted to be the CEO.
You wanted to.
No, but I think he's doing a great job. I'm 100% biased, of course.
Of course.
I'm glad he's in that role.
I mean, I feel like the shareholders would agree after the last earnings. But you did come, it wasn't maybe expected, because you kind of came up through the CE ranks in a different way than previous presidents and CEOs, because you didn't really come from a brand per se. You came
Correct.
Really with the Wall Street background of like the money side of things.
Yeah, Lisa and I both spent the majority of our careers in finance. But it, you know, it's one of the wonderful things about the company and the opportunity that it provides young people is really you could have several careers within your time at the company. So when I became chief financial officer, the company needed to find an opportunity outside of finance for Lisa. And you worked in two different functions,
yeah,
right?
First in purchasing and then in broader, what we call product supply, but manufacturing, engineering, logistics, and loved it. Never considered it before I walked into it and had really terrific experiences, which I would never want to have given up. So it was terrific.
And then I was offered the opportunity to be chief operating officer after I'd been CFO for 12 years. And that gave me exposure to the entirety of the company. And as part of that experience, I also had P&L responsibility for what we call our enterprise markets, which I think of those as the developing countries around the world, about 180 of them. So it wasn't as though I walked into this chair without ever having operated one of our businesses.
So what is it like, what is your job like today with so much of like the instability in the world? Because I know like we wrote for years, we would write like growing, it's growing worldwide, and this, the world is very chaotic at the moment.
It requires time and attention, as you would imagine, both to make sure we understand where things are headed, to make sure that we identify our role within that, to ensure that our organization is cared for and nurtured in very difficult situations, and to ensure that the communities that we live and work in are supported through those challenges as well. But while that's difficult, it's also gratifying to be able to help when help is needed.
How much do you have to watch what's happening? Is that, would you say that's a big part? Oh.
Lisa,
all the time he's watching what's happening.
She says, "You're just watching TV." I tell her, "No, I'm this is work."
You, I before we started recording, I told you that this is going to be a little different than what you're used to as far as all your appearances on CNBC. But I am curious, just digging in a little deeper, you know, P&G is a global company. I've lost track of how many countries you're in. When it comes to things like, you know, like specifically, let's say, the war in Ukraine, what's that like as far as, you know, you're not just a CEO of a national company. This is a global company. What has been the impact at headquarters here when there's war in the Ukraine, for example?
Well, there are several levels of impact. First of all, it's, you know, a very unfortunate situation all the way around. It requires that our other businesses step up and offset the challenges we're having in those markets. We have a real need in these situations to help people. When I look at what our Eastern European employee base did to house Ukrainian refugees on a semi-permanent basis, who they didn't know, to ensure that aid relief organizations that were relevant in this space were properly funded, both with product contributions and with financial resources. So the impacts are significant, and as you indicated earlier, they're piling up on each other, and it does. But look, you know, with all that, this is the biggest credit I can give to the team. In the last 5 years, it ended last fiscal year. That team, through all those challenges, generated $15 billion in incremental sales, putting us at the 85th percentile of the S&P 500. They generated $5 billion after tax in incremental profit, putting us at the 92nd percentile of the S&P 500. They created the 18th most valuable publicly traded company in the United States, the 25th most valuable in the world. And we've mentioned some of the geopolitical challenges. The last 2 years, we had the combination of commodities, foreign exchange, and transportation costs took out 50% of our profit. What was the team's response? To grow earnings per share. We are very fortunate to continue working with a team of very dedicated, very creative, very agile, and committed individuals.
Talk a little more about, because you kind of went through that very quickly. Again, the increase in cost, you said, related to transportation and
commodity
raw materials.
Costs, yes. Combined with foreign exchange, eliminated 50% of our bottom line. So had the team not been able to offset that, both through stronger top line growth, but also through productivity and cost savings, our earnings would have been half, our market value would have been half or less. But instead, they delivered growth on both the top and bottom line while increasing investments in our future and brand building and market growth in our operations with our retail partners. And we find ourselves in a very strong position as a result of all that. And knock on wood, that continues.
Do you think, so consumers obviously are affected by that just because of inflation. The cost of almost everything has gone up significantly. What else can be done so that the consumers aren't bearing the complete burden of that?
I mentioned productivity and cost savings. We try very hard to minimize the amount of pricing that we ultimately need to take. We also are very intentional in increasing our pace of innovation so that when we do have to take price increases, that's coupled with performance benefits such that the total value proposition is still an attractive one for consumers. And if you look at the last 4 years, our top line growth, 5, 6, 7, 7, which would indicate that we're doing a decent job of that. One of the questions related to your question has been, what's gonna happen? Fine, that's benefiting though from this pricing that you referred to. What's gonna happen to unit volumes? Well, if we look at North America, the last 5 quarters, -3 versus year ago, flat, +2, +3, +4 in the last quarter. So I think again, the team is doing a very good job of providing consumer value holistically defined. And so far, so good.
In terms of innovations, a lot of companies, ourselves included, as a media company, are exploring efficiencies through artificial intelligence. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like for a consumer company like yourself, consumer product company like Procter & Gamble?
I think it's very important we stay focused on the end outcome that we're trying to achieve. And I'll come to AI in a second. And that's the delight of consumers, customers, employees, society, and share owners. And when we lose sight of that and start chasing the bright, shiny object, we're lost. So one of the, I think, challenges in front of all of us, whether in your role or in mine, is really working to identify where AI can benefit the achievement of those outcomes. and focus on those use cases and those opportunities and where they exist, and I do believe they do exist, we should embrace the tool, but it's a tool. And we should avoid, I really rail against strategies within the company, for example, that talk about the use of AI or the use of blockchain or the use of, not because those are bad things, but that's not the job. And we just need to make sure we keep it in context.
I would agree with that. That's what we talk about in our world with media, that, AI is a tool. It's not a replacement for a reporter.
Right. It's not.
At least not yet.
I was asked a question at our global town hall last week about whether I thought AI was going to decrease enrollment or employment. And my response was that I didn't know, but that if you had a tool that made each person more productive, why wouldn't you want more of those people, not less? So I can see it going either way. The other thing, I reminded people, when I started with P&G, we were just starting to understand the potential of spreadsheets. And there was a lot of the concern you hear expressed around AI was expressed around spreadsheets. And certainly the finance organization, which Lisa and I were entering, was destined for the dustbin. Right? But no, what happened, exactly what I just described, which is spreadsheets enabled finance individuals and others to do things they weren't able to do before. And as a result, those people became more valuable, not less valuable, and we hired more of them. So I also tell people, I think we have more opportunities in front of us than at any time in the company's 180 plus year history. And part of it are these tools that we have available that allow us to innovate faster, we're taking innovation from a chemistry molecule standpoint off of the lab bench, and it's now we're doing discovery of molecules through some of these tools. But we need human guidance and interpretation and interaction and all of that. So again, I think we should collectively, sorry for the long-winded answer, we should collectively embrace this, but do it judiciously.
So we did skew a little bit CNBC. I'm kind of proud of ourselves, Burl, I'm not going to lie. certainly my husband Alex will be happy when I come home and I could talk about all of these things. We are running a little bit long. As any loyal listener knows,
We have two guests, so we need to give ourselves a little, we need to have a little multiplier.
I did want to end on a little bit of a fun note, because you have such a serious job, but you're an adorable couple. What do you guys do for fun?
We play golf together, okay. So that's fun.
We're actually very involved in the arts spend a fair amount of time there as well. It's a great way to unwind and relax and also stimulate your thought process.
And we love spending time with our family. Even though we don't have children of our own, we have lots of brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews, and so that's who we like to spend time with.
There you go.
Can I say something at the end here? Because we started in a place of talking about Arts Wave, and I would love, with your permission, to end in a place talking about Arts Wave and say
guest is always right. So
no matter whether you enjoy the arts or not, what Arts Wave's campaign is all about is making the city better. And we hope that anybody listening decides to give to Arts Wave if they're not giving already. And if they're already giving already, we hope they give more this year so that we can really try to take the campaign back to pre-pandemic levels and beyond, because all of us will benefit through the arts.
Could not agree more.
Well, that is well said. So just to remind everybody how they can get involved if you happen not to work at a place that does a company campaign. You can go to artswave.com.
I think it's
.org.
You can
Barbara, you're allowed to talk. You can just yell across the room. Our good friend Barbara Hauser is in the studio too. .org? Okay, she's doing the big O sign. Like, oh, org. And obviously, direct ways to give, direct ways to volunteer. If you happen to work somewhere that's not doing a corporate campaign and you're interested in bringing that online, there's resources to do that as well.
Absolutely. And you should think about that, because corporate campaigns are a great way to bring the organization together for a good cause.
Well, it is.
Anyone who wants to do that, just reach out to me on my social media and I'll make the connection for you.
They're going to hire you, Sherry.
Well, we don't want to just send people into the ether. I will make a personal connection for anybody who wants to do that.
Thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
Well, I do have to ask, since you put it out there, when you golf.
Oh, here we go.
When you do golf, who's the better golfer?
Lisa.
We're both about the
same. No.
I think we know the answer to that question. Lisa's very humble.
All right. Well, in our household, Alex is the better golfer.
Well, we can't thank you enough for your time. We established that you're both very busy. You are heading the Arts Wave campaign this year. And like I said, there are so many ways for people to get involved. I hope if our listeners are intrigued and are hearing what you're saying about the importance of investing in arts in our community, that they're inspired to help out. And we think
community-wide kickoff is February 6th.
Okay.
And if you want to join us at Music Hall on February 6th in the morning.
8:30 a.m.
February 6th, Music Hall, for the official kickoff.
And the announcement of the campaign goal.
All right. Well, we tried to get that out of you today.
A little bit of anticipation. I like it.
All right. Well, thanks again to both of you.
All right. So it turns out it was very different than last week's podcast
interview.
But I loved this one just as much.
No, that was fascinating. You know, I don't get starstruck very often. But when you're sitting across the table from the CEO of Procter & Gamble, it's one of those moments you're like, okay, this is pretty incredible.
I agree.
Yeah. And I didn't know what to expect. I, you know, had seen him at a couple events and things like that. But both he and Lisa, just super down to earth.
Yes, they were very easy to interview. I was a little bit nervous, like, about the business part of it, as much as I talked to Alex about, like, what he does for a living and covering Procter & Gamble in business.
Well, I mean, like we said from the beginning, if we would have called up and said, hey, we want John Mueller to come in and talk to us about Procter & Gamble, I think that would be a very different situation than we're here to. I mean, the purpose of their
visit was Arts
on
Wave,
our podcast
for sure.
Was because they've always given back to the community in a big way, and to be, like we said, the power couple behind the Arts Wave campaign this year. But it was fun too to get into a little bit of what's it like to be the CEO of Procter & Gamble? What are the things that keep him up at night? Just a really great conversation. And they're super nice people too,
yes.
which is always nice. So.
So we talked a little bit about the beginning, about what I was going to do with my Saturday night.
Yeah. So let me paint the picture. Okay. So, we had an opportunity, the Enquirer, to host some clients at the UC basketball game Saturday against the UCF, and a couple clients backed out at the last minute. And our sales director said, hey, bro, I got two extra tickets. Help me get rid of them. And this is what happens when you actually come back to the office and work. I look out there to see who's around, and it's you, Sherry. So I was like, well, Sherry's here. Sherry, do you want to go to the basketball game? Sherry says yes.
We thought it would be a good date night. Also, I'm very good friends with Burl's wife, so that was really the draw.
I know. That's the truth. But there was a caveat. Sherry said, well, we're going to be a little late because the mayor has called a briefing at 6 p.m. on a Saturday. So I was like, that's fine. I'm sure you'll get there before halftime. You barely made it before. I don't even think you were there at halftime.
Wait, you guys, we were losing. When we came like maybe like 2 minutes before halftime, like right before. They tried to talk us at the door. They tried to talk us out of coming in. They had really stopped letting people in at this point. And they're like, oh, we're losing so bad. They're like, do you really want to come still? And I was like, yes, I want to come
still. And even though this isn't sports talk, we have Kareem, our producer, who's pinch hitting for Phil. He's
I'm
at
here.
The mic now.
I'm
because
here now.
Kareem was at the game too.
I was.
And you were not shooting. You were
no.
You're a UC graduate?
I'm an 09 UC graduate.
I have two Bearcats with me.
So even though this isn't sports talk, it was one of those incredible comebacks. They were down, I think, 11 points
I
at the
know,
half.
I brought them
they
luck.
They were down
they're
12
welcome.
At half.
I know. I brought
half.
Them luck.
It's and then
nice.
I think it was your arrival. They outscored UCF, I think, like 40-something to 18 points
they won
in the second
by
half.
I think they won by 13.
Yeah, they won by more than they were down at the
yeah.
half. I mean, yeah, in the second half, if you just looked at the second half score, I think it was something like UC 47, UCF 18.
Now,
it was an amazing show of not just getting the offense together, but they put up a wall on defense.
Defensively. And usually, my friend John Kramer, I went to the game with him, normally he says every time somebody comes and plays at UC, one of their players has a career day. Well, that player was Avery for UCF. Anyway, he had 16 points total in all Big 12 games going into that game. He's finished the first half with 16 points. But to your point, Burl, they held him to 3 points in the second half. So defensively, it was a great show to watch the Bearcats play Bearcats defense to win the game.
Well, there are other podcasts to listen to, even here sometimes, about the X's and O's on the basketball court. I want to talk about what I think was a great Cincinnati moment, because that's what we do at the end of this podcast. And that's what happened at halftime. So many basketball teams do the half-court challenge, right, where they pick somebody, they pick a fan, and they give them a chance to, you know, win all kinds of things if you can sink a half-court shot. I think, like, the NBA sometimes does the million-dollar half-court. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, here at the University of Cincinnati, it wasn't quite $1 million, but it was something pretty cool, and that was a year's supply of Chick-fil-A. So I mean
that seems like if you
so,
eat Chick-fil-A, that seems like
I've seen
that's like a game show prize.
I've seen
that is a game show
challenge
prize
a million times in real life. I've seen like videos of people actually winning, but I've never been at a live game, like attending a game where someone has won the half court challenge. Until last Saturday.
So this was the big talk in the newsroom today, because somebody's writing a story about it. And
I signed it.
Oh.
Because here, let me.
But asking like a million questions, and they're like, Sherry, we're writing a story about it. The answers will be in there. But I was like, is it a random fan that's chosen? Like, what if I was chosen? Like, I could throw the ball, like, you know, like 5 feet. Like,
so,
I wouldn't be able to do that.
First of all, I have to say, it was so entertaining to watch, because this guy, they bring him out on the court. And you get three tries. So they have this little card. It's got three basketballs on it. And, you know, it's exciting to watch some guy.
Wait, was there, like, the cow that's all dressed up? Did they have, like, a
oh,
mascot?
Oh, yeah, the Chick-fil-A okay. cow was there.
Let's set
they
the
had
scene.
The works.
We're storytellers. Let's set the scene. Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so very nondescript-looking dude. He gets out there. His first shot almost made it. I mean, it hit the rim. It rolled. I thought it was going to go in.
Did everyone gasp?
I was like, oh.
Oh, yeah. People were focused on it. Yeah.
So he was not fazed one bit. He picked up the second ball. And, you know, I've played around trying to do half-court shots. I usually have to, like, take five steps and throw it like a baseball. I can't really do, like, a normal basketball shot. He pretty much did a what I would call a jump shot sort of thing. I mean, it wasn't, like, effortless. You know, he, like, launches the second shot.
From half court.
From half court.
Man.
Maybe he took two steps. You know, maybe, you know. Maybe his foot went over the line. I don't think that matters so much. But the second shot, nothing but net. The crowd goes wild.
The crowd was loud.
And he just turns around. You know, I would have been running around like, you know, like crazy. He just kind of, like, shrugs, puts both arms up, like, no big deal. I just sunk a half court shot. I get a year's supply of Chick-fil-A. So, the group we were sitting with, first of all...
Not me. I'm not there yet.
We are... Yeah, you're still hanging out with
Aftab. Well, basketball games are quick, too.
Yes.
They do go fast. Quickly, the discussion turned to, what does that mean if you win a year's supply of Chick-fil-A? Like, can you just show up there anytime you want and get food?
You have like a gold card kind
of thing. Do you get like a Chick-fil-A debit card? Like, can you bring your family in? And so we have this feature that we do called Just Askin', and we answer important questions like that. So I said to Jenny Key, our breaking news editor, and Aaron Couch, the reporter that usually does the Just Ask.
Which, if you're on breaking news, guys, you never know what's going to come your way. Like, I do wake up in the morning, you don't know what's going to happen.
Especially when I walk over, because...
But if you're on breaking news...
And you've filled in for that a couple of shifts. Yeah,
When I walk over, they try to, like, look busy because they're worried I'm going to have a story idea that they don't want to do. But they were just like, that's a great idea. So we got to find out what that means. So the answer is, and we will scoop, if you haven't read it, we'll just tell you right here. If you won, or this guy, what he actually won was a voucher for 52 vouchers, so he can basically have Chick-fil-A once a week for a year.
Oh, okay.
For free, though.
Meal vouchers.
So,
yeah.
Once a week.
Once a week, yeah.
Oh, I see.
Well, I don't know. Maybe he's got 52 vouchers, so if he wanted to, he could, like, you know, he could do two a week, but it would only last him a year. But I don't know, maybe they're day stamped or something like that.
It just reminds me of, you know, that, I don't know if you guys, that Seinfeld with Kramer, and he gets the lifetime cafe lattes.
Yes.
And he goes in every day, and then they start to get a little annoyed with him that keeps coming in. I hope that doesn't. I'm glad he has vouchers, though, so he doesn't.
But
have
it's
to
very much a game show prize. That's the kind of, like, lifetime surprise of Rice and Roni. Hey, guess what I watched when I was little? Like, all of the game shows in the morning with my grandma.
And when I heard he won the Chick-fil-A for a year, I was like, they're closed on Sundays, so I'm not sure if it's an entire year. That's all.
So yeah, that was the burning question that we answered on Just Askin' this week. If you win Chick-fil-A for a year, what does that really mean? And now we know. So, yeah, that was a fun moment. Sorry you missed it, Sherry.
That's okay. I feel like I got the flavor of it. And they won. And I had a very good time. And I don't regret. You know, when Alex and I was pretty tired at the end of that day. When we got home, I was like, I'm still glad we went. It would have been easy to be like, we missed most of the game. It was pouring down rain. It's like, felt very like a apocalyptic. It was thundering and light. Did you hear it in the arena? Because we definitely heard in the mayor's office.
All we could hear was people screaming.
Thunder,
and
lightning,
and
everything.
Game.
And it was like, are we really going to go up there? I mean, the Business Courier reporter, Chris Wetterick, is a good friend of mine. He actually drove us up there. He lives near there. And he drove, like, I was
so
like,
he dropped
I'm glad.
You off. Uh-huh. And then, yeah, that's the way to go. That is totally the way to go. And I was impressed too because it was a whiteout. So they encouraged fans to show up wearing white. I have nothing white other than what I wore to your dinner on Blanc.
I got the memo.
I did not get the memo whatsoever. Me and my friend John, like, looked at each other like, at least we're wearing red and black.
So it does. I can speak to with authority on this. So I have some football, UC football stuff. I didn't really have any basketball or more generic things. I do like to be on brand. So I went over to Cook's. We're very lucky to have Cook's downtown, like right by the Inquirer. And I was like, well, where is all of the white shirts? And it was like you had one choice for women and one choice for men. Like, it was all, but there was lots of choices, but they were all red and black and everything.
Right, yeah.
And so, like, we bought the white gear. I think that was by design. They wanted us to do that.
There you go. All right. Well, shall we wrap things up?
Yes, this was another great episode, Burl. I love doing this. You know what, though? I did want to say to everybody, thank you for listening to That So Cincinnati podcast, a production of The Inquirer and Cincinnati.com.
That So Cincinnati is sponsored this week by Cincinnati.com, the online home of The Enquirer. If you'd like to sponsor an episode, and who wouldn't, listen to by thousands each week, email me personally at blove@cincinnati.com.
That's So Cincinnati was produced today by Kareem, who just joined us, Alcazar, pinch hitting for the intrepid Phil Didion, who we missed. Lisa Gillespie books our guests and keeps us all in line. This is so true. Follow me and Burl on X, formerly Twitter, where I have way more followers than he does.
You do. And finally, if you value local journalism, please consider a digital subscription to The Enquirer. Just click on subscribe at the top of Cincinnati.com. And remember, Jojo was a man who thought he was a loner, but he knew it couldn't last.